Good morning. Rio Chaos, subtitle, what is it? And that's the subtitle, not because I know the answer, but because I don't. The work I'll describe today is mostly done with David Head, who is here, and Armand Ajdari from PACE in Paris. Here's an outline. I'll quickly remind you what rheology is. I'm sure most people know. Say a bit about shear banding, but mostly about flows which are spatially homogeneous but temporally unsteady, and under what conditions those might go chaotic and why. So until about 6 months ago, I knew nothing about chaos or dynamical systems or anything, and so I'm aware that, although it is traditional when one's learned something to assume that everybody else knows it as well, I'll try not to do that today. And so I'll give a kind of very brief detour on dynamical systems theory for those who either never went to such a course or have forgotten it. And then I'll say something about what appear to be the kind of big open questions in systems which are chaotic in non-Newtonian flows. And I'll say something about simple shear thinking models, work with David and Armand on those, about how in these systems the main thing about, you all know what the Navier-Stokes equation is, and you all know what turbulence is, and that's a chaotic dynamics of a nonlinear equation, but the nonlinearity in it is because of inertia. So what I'm labeling Rio Chaos today is where you have very little inertia, the Reynolds number is effectively zero, but there's nonlinearity and memory, and really the memory is what comes in to replace the inertia in giving you chaotic behavior. If there's time at the end, I'll say a little bit about fully fledged elastic turbulence. That's work which John Rallison drew to my attention when I gave a seminar on a similar subject, which he didn't attend in Cambridge. But he was at dinner the night before, and when I mentioned his title, he said, "Oh, you'll be talking about that paper by Grossman and whatever from the Weissmann, weren't you?" And I said, "Oh." So I downloaded it off the web that evening, and I did talk about it, but not in any detail. I'm sure that's right. Anyway, so there's a rheometer, couette, cone plate, two types of rheometer. The idea is to apply a steady shear stress and measure the strain rate or vice versa. I will not be talking tensors today. So you apply one and you measure the other. So normally the system will relax towards some steady state curve, which is called the flow curve, stress as a function of strain rate, sigma of gamma dot. In Newtonian fluid, that curve is linear. But it takes time to reach this state because the system has memory of some sort.
I'm just anticipating the answer that you came, since I would very like to. Did you persuade you to hold a pointer and this people who are sort of in this quadrant
here? Is this a pointer? It's something. Yes, it's unusual to have a screen, half of which is below waist height. Yeah. Well, I suppose all I can do is just keep moving, I think. So I should constantly pass in front of the screen to make it. Well, I could stand here. Right. Okay. So there. So considering just the shear stress and the shear rate, no tensors today. Conservative equation, so stress now is some thing which depends on the strain rate history. So scalarized, no normal stresses, nothing. Assume time translation symmetric system, so I'm not talking about aging today, although some of the models that we've looked at have glassy properties and therefore aging behavior. As I said, inertia negligible, so this is a different phenomenon from Navier-Stokes type chaos, which sets in at Reynolds numbers 10 to the 3. The Reynolds number is the ratio of the inertial to viscous term in the Navier-Stokes equation or similar. And these are about zero in the viscoelastic fluids I will talk about. So somehow memory and nonlinearity combine in such a way that a steady strain rate need not lead to a steady stress or vice versa. So what can go wrong with the simple flow curve here? Two things. So two kinds of instability. First one is to do with shear banding. So if you have a flow curve, which, say, you do an elaborate calculation and you have a model for it, and you predict a flow curve which has a piece with negative gradient, then that's unstable. It can be shear thinning type here. So a shear thinning curve is anything which drops below linear, shear thickening goes above linear. This is extreme shear thinning, where it actually goes below the horizontal, and likewise here for an extreme shear thickening curve. So why is this unstable? It's because if you have, in this region, if you have a local fluctuation which gives you a bit more flow locally, it gets positive feedback and gets pushed further in the same direction. So if you're on a decreasing part of the flow curve, you will either have an unsteady flow, or you can have an inhomogeneous flow, one which is spatially inhomogeneous, or both, in principle. The inhomogeneous case is typically leads to a composite flow curve, which you would actually measure, which is something like one of these things here. You crank up the stress, you come along the green line, and then it rises again. Sorry, crank up the shear rate. And there can be hysteresis around here in both of these things. This one is called discontinuous shear thickening when it's observed experimentally and when the experimentalists don't notice that it's got banding. So they call it discontinuous shear thickening. They just measure a curve which jumps like that. So,
Mike,
yes.
It depends whether what you control experimentally is the stress or the shear rate.
It is true. If you control the stress, you should be able to measure this branch here. If you're good at it. But that's not always true, you see, because if you control the shear rate, you can't measure this branch here, because it bands like that. So it depends on how long it takes, actually, to set up these bands. If you try to have a stress here, that is unstable to those two bands.
So what does represent your green straight line?
Well, that would be what you would measure. If you do this, if you do it at controlled gamma dot, you will see a jump. And if you do it at controlled stress, you will probably measure the green curve if you wait long enough between data points. If you go fast, you might get something like the dotted
line. Why would you see a jump before you get to the peak of the curve?
Well, this is depends on how long you wait here. There may be...
Either one.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, this may nucleate bands before it reaches the... This is like a spinodal point. This is totally unstable when you get to the top. But before you reach that, it may be unstable to certain kinds of fluctuation that the system can have, such as little, well, I assure you this is true. You can measure sharp corners on here in many systems. But I mean, it's true that this part here is metastable and you may be able to measure it. And there are systems where you can measure it some way up here, but not actually right to the top. It normally jumps, you know, in seconds before you get right to the top.
Well, usually when you see curves like that, you expect to see some sort of hysteresis.
Yes, there often is hysteresis, but it may not be quite as extreme as you'd expect. Yeah. Okay, so a little bit more about what happens with the banding, and I won't say much about this except in passing later. So when you have bands, you have regions of two different shear rates, possibly more than two bands, but here's the simplest, we just have two. You have some interface between them. So if it's the thinning curve, they have to be oriented like that. If it's thickening, they should be transverse in this sense. Peter Olmsted will talk all about this. But what you can do with some models, at least, is get an equation which tells you how this interface moves as a function or functional of the velocity profile there. So there usually is a solution to that equation, I believe I'm right in saying, or a steady state solution, but I think it's also fair to say that there are plenty of cases where the stability of that has not really been investigated. So something which could happen is that you could have a banded flow, but that this steady state solution is unstable and that interface will start wafting up and down and oscillate or possibly go chaotic. So that's certainly one route to rheological chaos.
Can you explain a bit more why the orientation has to be...
Well, I was going to leave that for... Peter on Thursday. Right. So, that's banding, and that's one sort of abnormal behavior. It can lead, if that interface was unstable and started moving up and down, it can lead to these observations like these here, but I believe you can also get these in systems which are spatially homogeneous. So, apply a steady strain rate and measure the stress, or the other way around. So what can happen other than a steady flow? One thing you can get is a limit cycle, so-called, which is where you just have a periodic, the steady flow is unstable to a periodic oscillation of stress in time, or strain rate in time if you control the other one, with a single period. You could have a quasi-periodic behavior where you have a sum of periodic pieces with incommensurate periods, which is the definition of quasi-periodic, or you can have chaotic behavior, which is fully aperiodic bounded motion and is to be sharply distinguished in from an experimental point of view from noise. If Didier remembers, and I visited his lab about 17 years ago, I did it on worm-like micelles in that banding flow, and we got data like that, and it ran on. We got this just, you know, the days of tape output, just a paper tape with a pen chart on it, and it went on with this huge noise, and it went on for hours and hours and hours, and we said, well, I'm a crap experimentalist. So, about 15 years later... So about 15 years later, Ajay Sood and his colleagues did basically the same experiment and were sensible enough to do time series analysis of that trace. And of course, it's chaos.
No.
Sood says chaos.
No.
For sure. You disagree? No.
I disagree.
Okay, well, we'll come to that later on. You presumably don't disagree with your own data, which is on onions, which it didn't show chaos, in fact, but did show spontaneous oscillation. So let me just show some data. Now, the question which is open at the moment is whether, certainly for Sood's case, whether that's also a banded flow. They say it is, and it may be in some of their systems, but I'm convinced that there are systems where banding is not essential to see chaos. So here's some of Didier's data with the Bordeaux group. So this is completely unrelated to micelles. It's a system of lamellar phase which makes onions. And, well, this one, the middle bit, might be chaotic, but what you certainly see here, this is controlled stress, and it's the strain rate which is being measured, is you see these systematic oscillations with a period of, which is really quite long, 20 minutes or something, of shear rate at controlled stress. So this is definitely not giving a steady flow. It's got a limit cycle, apparently. Here's some of Sood's et al.'s data. So they have it for shear thickening type micelles and shear thinning type micelles, and one of these curves is one of those and the other is the other, but I don't remember which. And Didier says this is not chaos.
Maybe it's not simple chaos.
Maybe Didier will
prove that it's chaos.
Well, I thought they did a pretty good job of proving that, actually. Sorry?
It looks, indeed does look irregular.
Well, what they did was they did time series analysis, which is a standard route, and I've forgotten what things they did, but they did try to get back out dimensions of attractors and things, and they said that there was an attractor with a dimension of between 2.5 and 2.9, which, if it's true, means there's chaos. Okay. So let me just back off from that and say a bit about attractors and stuff, dynamical systems theory, which will also serve to introduce some equations which, by kind of force of approximation, we will end up looking at things like them later on. So a dynamical system is a set of differential equations, which might cause you trouble because most rheology involves integral equations, but we'll come back to that later on. It's not a bad start, because an integral equation can be translated into a dynamical system of infinite order. And all the integral equations ever get used in rheology are finite order, because they all have exponential kernels. And I'll come back to that later on. Okay, so the order of such a system is basically the number of first-order differential equations that you can turn it into. And it's autonomous if you can write a set of equations with n equations, all first order, where the time derivatives of those n things depend on as functions of the coordinates. So n first order differential equations, and when you first get into this game, you have to remember that you can always turn a second order differential equation to first order equations, so that's why it's called second order, but this is really what order means here. So here's an interesting example, which is called the van der Pol equation, as most of the textbooks have a discussion of it. Take a coordinate, give it an acceleration, which is minus k times x, so that's like a harmonic oscillator. And this term here looks like a damping term, but it has a damping term which depends on where you are, with a positive coefficient here. And this is set up in such a way that you have negative damping at what would be the stable equilibrium position of the harmonic oscillator. So the way you turn that into the two first order equations is you write one equation which is a definition of a second coordinate as the time derivative of the first one, and then you have a first order equation linking x2 to itself and to the other. So that is a set of two equations like this. So in the Van der Pol equation, you set this up with, so this is just like a harmonic oscillator, but you set it up with the damping coefficient, which, as I said, goes negative around the equilibrium position. And that means that although this looks stable from the point of view of energy, it's not stable because a small perturbation there will grow. And it will grow until it reaches such an amplitude that over the course of the cycle, this damping term here has to put in as much energy in the middle part as it takes out at the extremes. And that's how it limits its amplitude finally. So there is no stable steady state. And what happens to the Van der Pol oscillator is a spontaneous oscillation, a limit cycle. So in terms of the two coordinates, x1, x2, or x and its velocity in this case, that means that if you start anywhere on this plane, you will end up on this red ellipse here. Right. And if that damping is fairly large in the tails and very strong anti-damping in the middle, the actual waveform you get from this oscillation, it has this characteristic shape, it's called a relaxation oscillator, where it sort of starts to develop a sawtooth-like appearance, if I remember correctly. Okay, so further comment, if you want to see, so that is a simple system giving you a spontaneous oscillation. If you want to see chaos, you have to have n bigger than 2, and that's because if you live on a plane, you can't have these green paths or trajectories of starting with different initial conditions. These can't cross, and that makes it impossible to have anything bigger than a limit cycle in a second order system. Right. You might expect chaos in some higher order analogues of Van der Pol. Further reading, textbooks, good textbooks, published by Cambridge University Press. And I enjoyed reading those. And I wondered why I'd never read them before last year. And such a poor education we receive over in the physics department. Okay. So, attractors. That red thing, the ellipse, is an example of an attractor. So an attractor is the place that trajectories end up at long time. So it's the asymptotic home of trajectories. And if you have a stable system which just goes to a steady state, then the trajectory is a point. It's a point, say, at, well, it might have, if x is the stress and this is its time derivative, it will have zero derivative, but it will have a finite stress here. But what that says is wherever you start, you end up on the red dot. And so the dimension of this attractor is zero because it's a dot. The Van der Pol oscillator has this ellipsoid, and the dimension of this is 1 because it's a line, although it's closed curve. And you can have finite integer dimension sort of tori, which corresponds to these quasi-periodic motions where you have a sum of periodic pieces of irrational periods, or you can get what is called a strange attractor, where this is some sort of fractally thing with a non-integer dimension. And that's the one which corresponds to chaos. So you can get from the time series, and this is what those guys, Ajay and friends, did, by looking at the correlations in the time series data, so you have, a stress as a function of time, you can get some information about the dimension of this thing, and this is what they said it was for worm-like micelles, in at least one of those two cases. I can't remember whether it was the thickening or the thinning case. And this is not like Navier-Stokes turbulence, where at least it's believed that the dimension of this attractor is very large. At least it's believed by me. I presume it's believed by everybody. Right. So, what don't we know? Everything. We don't know how many degrees of freedom you need to have in your equations to get real logical chaos. And a slightly different question is, we don't know what order the system has to be. We know it has to be at least two, but we don't know what order of these two things are not the same thing, because, say, the stress, if I just have a single coordinate, which is the stress, and its time derivatives, that's one degree of freedom, but it can have a high order differential equation, so these two things are slightly separate. Do you need to have possibly banding to get this kind of data, or do you need some other kind of spatial inhomogeneity, which might not be banding, but might be sort of eddies and stuff? Or might you get it in equations or in systems where the stress is basically uniform through the sample, but just not steady in time? And there's some hint that that's what's happening in the onion system, which oscillates, because at least at the two extremes of that oscillation, the system is spatially homogeneous, and I think it probably is most of the way through it. I don't know if you agree with that. So it seems that there are some systems where you can have a uniform state of flow which is still unsteady. So that is the case that I'll be looking at in the rest of the talk mostly. This case has, as I said, one degree of freedom, but in general it's infinite order because it has some sort of integral equation controlling it, and that's what real logical equations usually are, and as I'll say again later, that corresponds to an infinite order differential equation. So, or you can say, well, probably there's banding, and this I think is what Sood et al. Argue, and so then maybe you have some sort of interface here. Now this interface could start wandering, so it could either wander again, stay flat and move up and down in time, so that would be one degree of freedom again, but again we don't know what order of a differential equation would control that, or it could start wobbling about in space as well. Or you may need something which is analogous to fully developed turbulence in Navier-Stokes problem. You may need to understand these systems to consider cases where the stress is a fully spatially and temporally varying infinite number of degrees of freedom, same with H if it's a function of the transverse variables here. Right. So what I'm going to do is, for most of the rest of the talk, just look at this one, which obviously makes life much simpler and I think shows some physics, although it may be that in many systems we're in one of these cases here. So this is option one, homogeneous flow. So then I don't need any spatial degrees of freedom at all. I just talk about a stress as a function of time. And there's two routes into it, which I'm going to elaborate on. One is a mesoscopic model, which is inspired by work we've done on jamming and related behavior, using ideas originally from glassy dynamics, although in this particular model you don't need any glassy dynamics. But the behavior there is quite rich, but to understand it is actually fairly difficult, and even to explore it, because there's a lot of heavy-duty numerics, which David kindly did, to get physics out of that model. So I'm focus more on a very simple equations where you just kind of cast onto the screen differential equations for stress. And that they're even quite nice looking equations because there's no tensors here. Limit cycles are relatively easy to get. And the interesting thing is you can get them without having to have this on your flow curve. The models I'm talking about are shear thickening type models today. In other words, you can have a flow curve which in steady state is like this, but has a region of instability on it. And what I will try to argue is that what's really happening here is that you have a flow curve which is like this, but is only like this rather than like that because of some very delayed or very long-lived memory piece in the equations. And so that if you think about the response to a kind of very short time response to a perturbation, it might think really that it's on this flow curve, but then if you wait for the thing to settle out, it knows that this curve is actually monotonic. But you might imagine that if there are fast processes which have this kind of behavior underneath there, that that would be enough perhaps to get the thing go unstable. So we have real chaos in, I'll show you equations, continuum equations later, which are chaotic. We didn't get it in the mesoscopic model, but we did get the limit cycle.
Can you just explain a little more about that, Mike? What do you mean by fast processes?
Well, the left curve and... I will be coming back to that.
Okay, fine.
Mesoscopics. An ad hoc model, nonetheless. And derived from, as I said, earlier models on glassy dynamics, which Suzanne Fielding knows all about. So let's assume then, and the case I'm going to think about is that I'm driving this at constant shear rate. I'll keep swapping from one of these to the other, but let's say, assume that the shear rate is homogeneous and constant, but the stress is homogeneous above some mesoscopic scale and might vary in time. And that this model has got an infinite number of degrees of freedom in the sense that it describes a population of mesoscopic lumps. And the model is here. So think of these globs as just sort of lumps, which doesn't mean that they are actually particles. They're just kind of pieces, elements of the system, which are big enough to behave in some sort of locally elastic way. And I have a population, which is time dependent, of local strains, L. So L here is, I've chosen units, so it's dimensionless and it's a strain. And the elastic constant is K for each of these elements. So what I have then is a distribution of these local strains, and I, did I say it here? I define the stress to be the elastic constant times the average of this L.
L is not a length,
it's a strain, I'm afraid. No, the stress is down here. No, it's the same for everybody.
Okay.
But they don't all have the same L at any particular time because they're hopping, as I'm about to describe. So the idea is that I have these mesoscopic elements can be strained, but then locally they can yield, they can rearrange somehow. And in the simplest version of the model, you give them a local rearrangement rate or a jump rate, gamma of L, which depends on the strain. And as soon as they have such a rearrangement, you just reset the local strain to zero, so that element stops carrying any stress, and then it has to be sheared again before the stress builds up, and then it will jump again. But the jumps are stochastic. This is a rate, but they are random. And if you have a model like this, you can write down a equation of motion for this probability distribution, which is that dp by dt, now this piece here says that between jumps, L dot is gamma dot. This just says between jumps you just crank up L at the rate gamma dot. So that's a dp by dl here. So that just pushes everything up the L distribution. And then this term has stuff jumping out of the distribution of L back to zero. And this term here, which is where this W is the total rate of jumps over all the L's times their probabilities, so that's the total jump rate, is the rate at which stuff is jumping back into L equals naught. So that's what this delta function here means. So I have an L-dependent rate of jumping back to zero strain, or zero local stress, and that's what the two terms on the right-hand side are. And this is just affine straining. And the stress, we say, is a constant, elastic constant times the first moment of this distribution. So this is, because P is a continuous function, this has an infinite number of degrees of freedom. And the case that I'm going to describe is where we choose, perhaps rather ad hoc fashion, we choose this jump rate to be non-monotonic and have a inbuilt predisposition to shear thickening, which is sort of, you know, possibly cheating. But what's interesting is when you do this, how the system then behaves collectively, because those elements are all talking to each other through the fact that I'm that the system is being strained. So if we choose a jump rate which looks like this, so if I have a jump rate which is finite for an unstrained element, so it could just hop, and as I strain it, it will tend to be more likely to rearrange. That actually gives me a bit of shear thinning. But then let's suppose that I reach some point where maybe it clunks into its neighbors or something, and this jump rate then drops. So that's locally a kind of jamming tendency at some intermediate strain. And then eventually, if I really go on pulling it, it will hop eventually. So this thing could certainly be, you could imagine it giving you a non-monotonic flow curve, because if all the elements are doing roughly the same thing, then they might all get jammed up around here. But the interesting thing is that you've got to get anything like an unsteady flow, you have to somehow have a collective process which locks in these elements so that they're moving coherently up and down this curve. Anyway, do I need this bit about convenient language? I don't think I do, actually. Let me ignore the bottom part there, but there's different ways of just putting in this function. That's the way we put in this function, which happens to have a step in it, but I don't think that matters for what I'm going to say. So if you take this with that kind of shape there, and play around with the parameters, you can get the following thing. This is what David found numerically. And this, I hope, well, okay. You get a flow curve which is monotonic, but is unstable in some region of stress. So the fact that the flow curve is monotonic says that you're not getting shear bands. So there's no reason why the system wants to make shear bands, and it won't, which is lucky because, we were looking for a case where the flow was homogeneous. But nonetheless, between these two stresses, you have an unstable flow. And it basically, in between these stresses, it behaves like a relaxation oscillator.
Quick question, just for clarification.
Yes.
So you're saying in some window of the parameters that describe this complex curve, the following is true?
Well, the describe...
Not for arbitrary choice of the shape.
No. You have to have a big enough bump in it, or a big enough drop here.
So when you paint, you actually have a completely discontinuous
structure. Oh, we did. That's what's sort of written down there. Sorry?
Do you need that? Because you never...
No. Yes, I think. Yeah, it has to have a fairly steep drop, but it doesn't matter that we happen to choose a one with a cliff there. That's not significant. Here's the cliff. This is, an effective temperature, but I don't want to... It's not pertinent to discussion today. Right. The other comment is that if you do that and then you take a time average of the stress, so the stress is oscillating in this region, so you don't live on this curve because you don't have a steady flow. The stress oscillates, and if you average it, you interestingly do get something which comes backwards like this. So this sort of looks a bit like a shear thickening curve might. But at controlled stress, you definitely measure the blue points as a time average. Right. So I probably have pictures of those oscillations, but I'm not sure. It's the time average of the stress over the limit cycle. So between those stresses, it's here and here. You have bifurcation points, and you have a small amplitude wobble, and in the middle you have a big amplitude wobble, which looks like a kind of vaguely sawtooth-like relaxation oscillator.
And this time rate is wobbling, not the stress, isn't it?
You must impose the stress initially.
Which way around am I, David? He knows. So, I put a bar over this and not over that. Excuse me for my... I told you I'd keep changing, but this is certainly... Okay, that's the way it is in this model.
So, I haven't quite understood exactly what the meaning of dotted line is. Because if you do have a limit cycle, I don't understand what the meaning of the, as it were, steady state.
Okay, so the limit cycle, you impose the stress, and you measure the average strain rate over the cycle. And then that comes back here. So this is in this region, it's getting transiently jammed.
Okay.
an unstable solution to the equations.
So this dotted line is the unstable steady flow curve, and if I did a time average over the actual answer, which is getting periodic here, if I look at it, it's getting jammed, unjammed. The average strain rate is less than it would have been if it had managed to stay on that curve, which it doesn't
do. The type of instability that is underlying that curve, you can't guess it from the curve, right?
You certainly can't guess it from the dotted curve.
Right.
No, that's the point. I mean, that's actually quite important, I think, because, as I say, with the banding, I mean, you know as soon as you see this negative slope that it's unstable, and you know why.
Is that unstable for both control stress and control strain, or just control stress?
I'm not sure that it's really, the model is really defined for the other one, is it?
There's a green and red on the board.
That is true. So, you see, I'm not even remembering this very well. Okay, so you can do it. You can do either. Yes, of course you can do either. You can dial in a fixed gamma dot, and then you have to live on this curve.
Mm-hmm.
But if you dial in a fixed stress, it oscillates. That's correct.
Do you expect the behavior to be the same on the way up or on the way down when you have such a...
Well, this curve here is stable,
yes,
and then it has a bifurcation and it goes into the limit cycle there.
Uh-huh.
And it stays in the limit cycle as you move up here, but it changes the waveform from sinusoidal to this sawtooth-like thing, and then it becomes smaller and smaller amplitude and is sinusoidal again here, and then it becomes stable. So that, if you did that slowly, it would just track that out, so there's no hysteresis in that sense.
Yeah, but now assuming that you start at high stress and high shear rate on the stationary, and you just come down.
Yeah, then there's a bifurcation.
What will happen here?
Well, there's a bifurcation point to sinusoidal, small amplitude sinusoidal oscillation, and it grows as you come down. But of course, there can be, if you do this fast, I mean, there can be transients of all kinds, which is extremely complicated. Okay. So one of the things which is, so there's definitely interesting stuff happening here. Yes.
If gamma dot's constant, the steady flow is stable, what's the stress do? Does the stress oscillate? Or
no. Constant gamma dot, you get constant stress. If you force gamma dot to be constant.
That's what steady flow is stable.
Yeah. So what it says is that the instability of this curve is somehow this way, not that way. Right. So if I insist that I live on a line here, it's stable to perturbations in that direction, but not this one.
Michael?
Yes.
If I want to think about the underlying instability as living in another axis perpendicular to that plane, what should I put on that axis?
Well,
key and transitory behavior, or
I wasn't going to say much about this, but the fact is that you, in the model, you have this P of L. You've got this whole distribution. And what happens is in the unstable region, it becomes more bimodal and starts splitting into two and going back to one and two and back to one and two and back to one. Whereas in these parts here, it's pretty unimodal in both, or? Yeah. So if you wanted to have an axis out here, you could do it by taking some sort of order parameter in this P of L thing that would tell you how broad the distribution was relative to the mean, something like that. But in fact, to be honest, I mean, we've thought quite a bit about what, I do have some transparency I wasn't going to show about what happens to the distribution there. I think probably it's better if I just move on to the continuum models, where hopefully a bit of the physics behind this will be clearer anyway. Hopefully. Can I do that? Shall I do that? Yeah. Okay. So let's try to be simpler. And let's just, as I say, chuck constitutive equations onto the screen. However, this is somewhat inspired by what I've just been talking about. So here's a constitutive equation. What this says is that if I apply, and now from this part, I'm talking about imposed gamma dot now, so this is different. Gamma dot now is a constant fixed by me. And let's set the elastic constant to 1, in which case this thing here says that as I apply my constant shear rate, the stress would, if everything was elastic, just linearly increase in time. But I still am thinking of some arrangement of elements which can jump. So let's give this a jump rate. So this is a decay rate, R of sigma, or actually sigma times, that this is sigma times a decay rate. And let's suppose that this is non-monotonic. So this is has in it the equivalent of this gamma of L idea. But now there's no L, there's no locally varying strain variable, there's just a global stress sigma. And I'm saying that sigma tends to decay at a rate which is not monotonic in sigma here. And for a reason that I hope will become clear in a minute, I'm going to plot this as R of sigma, but that way around, with sigma vertical and R horizontal. And so that is an S-shaped curve. So this rate goes up with stress and then drops and then comes back again. And then what I've got here, so that's instantaneous. And what I've got here is a bit of memory. So this is an extra jump rate and its coefficient is lambda. And what this says is that maybe these jumps take some time to happen or there's some sort of collective nature to them, which means that once a jump has been triggered, that process is set in train, and even if I try and back off the stress, I can't stop it happening. And so therefore, this jump rate cares about stresses which were in the system a little while back. So this is more than relaxation, which is already contained here. You could, I suppose, if you're a rheologist, you might call it retardation or something like that. And if you want, you can think of this thing as a retarded stress. It's a stress which is actually time averaged over some memory kernel, but cares about recent rather than current stresses. So if I choose this memory kernel to have weight 1, so its integral is 1, that gives me the amplitude of this kind of delayed jumping piece here.
But
right.
This mine doesn't need to have any of this non-monotonic.
No.
Behavior of
it, lambda is not. It's linear. It's linear memory and nonlinear instantaneous, this model. I'll make both memorable later on. Okay. Well, I'm sorry, that sounded boastful. I didn't mean it. Right. Okay, well, if you look at the steady state here, if there's a steady state, this integral is just sigma. So what's interesting is that, okay, a steady state says that's zero, so gamma dot minus R minus lambda sigma equals naught. So if I didn't have this lambda term, R of sigma would be gamma dot. So that's the flow curve. So that's why I plotted it like this. In other words, without that term at all here, this is the flow curve with gamma dot written where R is. So what I'm going to do is I have this flow curve which obviously has a natural tendency to instability in it because it's got this decreasing piece. So in other things being equal, that would have to shear band or something. But I add this linear term, but which is delayed. Nonetheless, in steady state, the amplitude of this is enough to unwrap that fold there and give me this black curve here. So I'm choosing parameters so that without the delayed jumps, it would be manifestly unstable, but with them, it looks okay. So it's monotonic. So that just says that lambda has to be big enough. Right. Now, this is a dynamical system, but for a general memory, it's infinite order, as I've said several times before. However, you can choose particular kernels here to make it finite order, and there's lots of ways to do that. The simplest case, which I will go through on the next view graph, is to choose an exponential kernel, which makes it second order. But I could choose a sum of two exponentials, and it would be third order, or a sum of three, and it would be fourth, etc. And there are also things like x times an exponential of minus x is again second order. So there's all these plausible looking, but definitely not the most general kind of kernel, which reduces this to a finite order set of differential equations. But in general, it is infinite order. So you have to worry about how typical any particular kernel is going to be. So let's take the special case. Do you?
Mike, Is it possible to make reference to characteristic times or not in this
Well, there is a time attached to this.
Yes.
And that's about it.
Yeah. There's no characteristic time on the simplest left part of your equation.
Well, not other than gamma dot, which is a rate. So
the instability, which is in the sigma r curve.
Yes.
Or r of sigma curve.
Yes. Well, there is a characteristic time, which is the gamma dot at which all this happens, and so that the maximum value of r, say, gives you a gamma dot. A characteristic gamma dot at which you get out of the Newtonian regime and you start seeing the thickening and the instability. So there is a characteristic time which just lives in this relaxational part here, as you said.
So how do they compare when you compare the characteristic time?
That's a good question.
And sigma gamma dot, or the gamma dot at which you have the instability.
Well, in the examples we looked at, they're of similar magnitude because they're both kind of one-ish plus or minus a factor of 10. But it's an interesting question as to whether you get strongly different behavior if you make those deliberately extremely different.
It looks like the time you need to be on M, if I follow your curve there, is just big enough to have the delta R difference between the two tips of
Well, sigma, this is not no, because you see the only thing which does this is lambda. This doesn't care what the delay time is.
Is it some combination of lambda and delta time?
It's just lambda the way I've normalized this. In steady state, integral of m is 1 and sigma is a constant, you see. So, I mean, obviously the time scale of m does matter, we'll see in a minute, but what it doesn't do is affect the flow curve. So what I'm going to say on the next view graph is if the process which stabilizes this curve is too slow, it's not actually stable. It just looks stable in the sense that it's got a positive slope. But it's, you know, it takes ages to work out what it ought to be doing and it constantly trying to catch up. Okay. So let's look at the simplest possible case, which is exponential kernel, Maxwell. So those of you who are used to Maxwell models will be well aware that if you have a Maxwell an integral equation with an exponential kernel, you turn it into a differential equation by differentiating and substituting a few things. So if we do that here, you get a nice, interesting, very simple structure to the equation. Namely, you get an equation for, so you have to differentiate a second time, you get an equation for the second time derivative of the stress, and it has something which I'm going to write suggestively as minus dv by d sigma and a beta of sigma times sigma dot. This is n equals 2, second order, because of that choice there. So I can think of this as a particle of unit mass in a potential v with a damping, which depends a bit on where it is, called beta. And here's the potential. It involves the integral of r, and it involves the lambda piece, and it involves gamma dot. And here's the damping, and it involves the derivative of r, and 1 over tau. Right.
So is the integral of r, that's what sigma is limit, or is that the complete integral of r?
It's the integral up to sigma of r d sigma.
It's a primitive.
Which I thought was what that notation meant, actually, but anyway. Sorry. okay. So what that says then, let's see what's happening here. So two things I need for a steady state. If I think of this equation here, the only steady state can be at a place where the potential has zero slope, right? So that is in fact the equation for the flow curve. If I differentiate this, or set this equal to naught, so if I differentiate that, I just get my flow curve back again. I get r lambda sigma minus gamma dot equals zero, which was the equation I had before for the flow curve. So that's that this kind of potential is nice, but all it's doing is just finding the flow curve for me by giving me the minimum of this function here. Now, for that to be stable, I need two things. Firstly, it has to have positive curvature at the minimum. So it would be unstable if it has negative second derivative, but since the first derivative is the flow curve, that just says it's unstable if the flow curve is pointing downwards. So that's the usual thing of a flow curve with negative slope being unstable. So that's the shear banding type of instability corresponding to this. But there's a second way in which this can be unstable, which I mentioned before in the context of van der Pol, namely, if this damping function here is the wrong sign around the origin. So what's the damping function? Well, the damping function is interesting because it has r prime, which is intrinsically negative, because I designed this slope r, this curve r with the negative slope in it. So the fact that this is negative is the same instability as on the kind of bare flow curve, if you like, but that's been ironed out by the lambda term to make this a stable minimum, but it can still have negative damping if tau is too big. So unless the piece of the equation which brings the flow back into stability is sufficiently agile and rapid in its response to time perturbations, it can't do the job. That's what this says.
That still not fails.
No, and that's not surprising because n equals 2. Right. So obviously, we have to if we want to see chaos, we have to have n bigger than 2, and there are various ways you can go with that. Yeah, let me just show you the kind of oscillation you get there. So this is a typical case. That's stress as a function of time, a relaxation oscillation with sort of fairly random parameters from that model I've just described. Right. So looking for chaos. There are various things which we tried. One is to take a more complicated kernel, say sum of two exponentials and so on. It turns out that these things are not actually don't seem to work very easily. It's harder than I thought it would be to get this thing to go chaotic, but we did manage. Here's how. That's to delay both terms a little bit. So here's the same equation. If I just drop this one here, that's instantaneous. This I call sigma 2, and it's that integral with the Maxwell kernel in there. And there probably should be a 1 over tau 2 in this definition. This is the similar kind of nonlinear shape to before, so it's S-shaped, but let's delay this stress in here a little bit as well. Not as much as that one, but a little bit. So then the flow curve is exactly the same as it's exactly the same construction as before for the flow curve. This is intrinsically would be like that, and I use lambda to unfold it like this. And then when both of these terms have a finite delay on them, it's a third order system. And it turns out that for some parameters is indeed chaotic. So whether you think that's significant depends on how much of the physics of nonlinear rheology you think is lived in an equation like this. I think it is quite interesting. I'm not sure that it is necessarily relevant to any particular experimental system that I would like to point to.
Oh, I'm not following the tau 1 and tau
2. Well, what I had before was written down here. So this is instantaneous, and this I'm now calling sigma 2. That retarded stress there I'm calling sigma 2. And then if I do the same trick of having a kernel on this stress in here and call that sigma 1, but with a different memory time.
Oh, it's inside the argument bar.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's right. So, I mean, we tried various things, but what you seem to need is nonlinearity, or rather you need to have memory inside the nonlinear term. But in fact, that on its own isn't enough either. If you put a two exponential kernel in there and leave this instantaneous, that doesn't work. So, but you can see why, because then this is still, it's something to do with the fact that the restoring the positive slope of the flow curve is delayed. Right. So. So you go into as you go up that curve, you enter a limit cycle, and then this is for some set of parameters which I could read out but won't. And these are all in kind of dimensionless units. So you have some limit cycle, and you see a period doubling sequence. So this is the lambda bit of the stress against the total stress. So you have an oscillation here in which you retarded stress is oscillating. That's the argument of R, so you can think of this either way. But anyway, this is, that is the total, so that's got sigma 1 and sigma 2. This is the same as sigma 2. You could have plotted sigma 1 against sigma 2, I suppose, and that would look rather similar. So it says that you have these orbits, and this is period doubling, as you can probably detect if you're used to looking at period doubling. So it goes around once, and then it goes around twice before coming back, etc., and then you reach chaos at this number here. And those numbers don't really mean anything. They're just parameters dialed into that model. So here are the parameters, actually, as it happens. That's the strange attractor, thanks to David. So this one has quite a lot of delayed term, largish lambda, quite a long delay attached, and a reasonably short delay on the nonlinear jumping term. So the linear term is delayed a lot, the jumping term is delayed little, and that's just a polynomial for that R of sigma, and away you go. So what is the physics of that? Well, it's not really clear to me yet. Something which is true, though, is if you look at this, what it's saying is that if I just take the final flow curve, this green curve here is still a shear thickening curve, right? The jump rate, the average jump rate, is going down here because this is going up above the linear. So what we're saying is that in the region where the average jump rate goes down, right, it doesn't go down enough to actually fold back the average rate, but in that region, at the same time, you're getting more of this, and so the jumps are taking sort of longer to sort themselves out. So if you imagine that you have some tendency to shear thickening, and then when you get into that region, the jumps are not just fewer, but they're kind of more complicated, they take longer, and they somehow have more memory attached to them. For example, if there's a kind of avalanche in these jumps, and so that, you know, you set something off and it keeps going for a while. That's your inertia, essentially. It's kind of, it's not inertia, but it's a viscoelastic analog of it. Then that's what you need, at least in this kind of model, this sort of model. So what I want to do, if you don't mind waiting a few more minutes, is to give you a kind of conclusion based on what I've described then now, and then mention two more things which are completely unclear in my mind, but maybe will stimulate a bit of thought while people are here at the ITP. So if I give you the conclusion first. Okay. So limit cycle, spontaneous oscillation, unsteady flow in relation to fixed stress, no problem. Experiment has it, theory has it, there may be nothing whatever to do between the two, of course, because I don't know enough about the experiment as to whether I know that most of the experiments are not obvious candidates for the kind of jamming model I described, but I think the message there is that probably it is wise to look at very simple theoretical models to try to get some handle on the physics before delving into, you know, fully tensorial, nasty constitutive equations. Chaotic behavior at essentially zero Reynolds number. Experiment has it, theory has it, with a question mark if you believe this two-delay thing. I don't see anything wrong with it myself, but it's perhaps a bit elaborate. Even less link. Memory is there instead of inertia. I should say, and as Tom was reminding me before, it's not new, this stuff, in the sense that people have known that viscoelastic flows can go unstable in various ways, and especially in instability of shooting polymers through pipes and stuff like this. what's interesting with this kind of system is that you have a viscometric flow and it's still going unstable, and so you can do the time series analysis on the stress, and if you're Paul Callahan, you should be able to get in there with your NMR and see what's really happening. Maybe the time resolution doesn't quite tie in with what, what you can manage there. But it seems to me that that's a more promising place to start than, for example, shark skin instability of extruded polymers. Maxwell kernel is tractable but not typical because it is, as I've said, changes a infinite order differential equation to n equals 2 if you're not careful. As soon as we got into n equals 3, well, you can get chaos, but we so far have needed to have these two different decay channels, a fast one and a slow one. The physics is unclear, but I think involves the kind of thing I was talking about just now. What we don't know is whether a minimal model like this has enough physics in it to describe any data. We don't know really if you agree that the experiments and the theory are two different things at the moment. We don't know, to get close to the experiments, what's the lowest N and what's D and what kind of sized model. You see, our models are very small. They just have a stress and its time derivatives. Back to this thing of whether you need to have spatial inhomogeneity, shear banding, and so on. And spatiotemporal chaos, which I'll come back to at the very end. Let me put up one quick thing about chaotic banding. This is yesterday's work, which proves that I've done something since I was here, even though yesterday was a holiday, I'm told. Because it was a holiday, I did some work, yes. Didier is right. Okay, think of the banded case. So you have bands and you have a height, and you want some equation for the height as a function of time. And can this equation be chaotic? How complicated an equation do you need for it to have that possibility? Well, here's an incredibly simple equation, which I think was first written down by Armand Ajdari, but is very close related to something which Jacqueline Govias and David Pine did. I think they had a sigma f minus 1 instead of this thing here. H is the height. This is for shear-induced gelation, where you say you're shearing the thing, part of it gels up, so you have a static region here, but it's maintained by the stress, so that you have a stress-induced gel and just a sort of quasi-Newtonian flow up here. So this equation is very simple. It says that you have a relaxation. Is this right? Yes. This f of h here says that depending on the height of the gel, I affect the concentration of stuff in the sol. There's a stress-induced deposition, if you like, of that stuff onto this surface. And there's a steady evaporation rate or something like this. At least that's the interpretation if you write this as sigma f minus 1. I'm not sure quite what Armand's interpretation for that equation is. So f of h is the volume fraction in the sol that you will have, given that the gel has some higher density rho, that ratio. So I thought yesterday about what would happen if you tried to do this experiment at a controlled strain rate, which is quite interesting, because if at controlled strain rate the gel were to grow, this gap gets narrower, so the stress has to go up. So that looks like positive feedback. Well, it is positive feedback. So you might think that there was a chance of an instability there. And there is. So it depends on the shape of this function, which is connected with the density in the gel. So if I put this down as a still an instantaneous equation, but under, this is the same equation under controlled strain rate. So I have an F, and I have a piece here which contains a plus H. So that's your positive feedback. But F has negative feedback in it, because as the thing grows, it depletes the sol here. So if I keep this thing stable, so I have enough negative feedback from the fact that the density of the gel is higher than the sol, so the sol runs out as the gel grows, but positive feedback from the fact that the stress goes up as the sol grows. But I'll keep this stable, but then I'll put a delay on this F term. So that's maybe not got much connection with the real world, but it says that the gelation is quick, but the equilibration of the density is slow. I'm not sure whether that's the right way around, but it's a way around. Might be plausible if it's a fairly dense system. So if you do that, you just get a identical structure to the kind of thing I was describing for the stress equation in the homogeneous case, a differential equation with an effective potential and an effective damping. And the effective potential is written down here, and the damping is there. And just as before, if you choose it so that it's basically looks stable, that corresponds to V having a minimum, so that's fine. But you still have anti-damping here if the delay time is too big. So if the thing takes too long to realize that it should have a higher density in the gel, you can have an instability. The trouble I had with this yesterday, and I still have, is that this has always got the same sign. So as written down, it's either going to explode or be stable. It's not going to oscillate. So you'd have to somehow say that this time for the density to relax depends on where the band is, and it gets faster if the gel nearly fills the cell or there's hardly any of it. I haven't really thought that through at all. But anyway, the same sort of opportunities are there for very simple differential equations purportedly describing the dynamics of the interface to show chaotic behavior as soon as you start putting in enough different types of memory. Last thing. This is the paper which John Rallison told me to read, so I did. It's a very interesting paper. So what these people did is they got a polymer solution just around, or just below C star, just below the entanglement threshold, and put it between parallel plates, which is a sort of rather unhappy thing to do because that's not got a constant shear rate in it, even at the best of times, but that's what they did. And they decorated the fluid with little reflecting particles, and they sheared it at a steady rate, and they got structures like this. Aha, they say, this looks like turbulence, which it does. So the Reynolds number here is less than one. That may seem a bit high to people who don't know Navier-Stokes fluid mechanics, but that's still very low by ordinary turbulence standards. The Weissenberg number is more than one, and it goes into a chaotic regime. And they started looking at this, trying to get the statistics of this. There's a lot more to be done there to get accurate statistics, for example, of velocities and time correlations of velocities and things like this in such a flow. So, a question. Okay, that is now got fully spatio-temporal chaos. So you obviously need an equation which has all spatial degrees of freedom in there. You can't use this kind of toy equations, just sigma and sigma dot as a function of time. Question, what equation? Well, around, well, certainly a bit below overlap threshold, things not very entangled, there's quite a lot of equations which work fairly well for that kind of flow in that kind of polymer. And what you ought to be able to do is to write down such equations at zero Reynolds number and show that they're turbulent. So I got as far as writing down the equations for upper convected Maxwell model, and I'm happy to discuss that with anyone who wants to do so, but I think I should probably stop the official talk and not put them up, unless people are particularly keen to just carry on for another 5 minutes, but I don't suppose they are. So thank you for your attention. Well, I'll carry on if people want, but let's maybe we should get any other stuff out of the way first.
That it's that the equations look easy at the end. You have the scalar quantity, the shear stress, and you discover everything. And then you have, but then these delayed kernels appear, right? But if you would work with a full stress tensor, for example, then you could do simple things without
yes.
any delayed kernels.
That's a good question. I think you probably do need one. I believe that you have to have. Yeah. But I agree completely that it would be very interesting and very nice to develop a model where you had, for example, a normal stress and a shear stress, and they were talking to each other, and so your N is immediately 3. That is another route. Whether you can do it without any delay beyond the simple relaxation, I don't know. I rather doubt, but it would be very nice to find out.
Yes, I think one can.
in connection with the second rank tensor associated with the flow alignment. We looked at that problem. If one takes five components of that second rank tensor, then one for sure gets chaotic behavior. If it's just three of those components, then one has, what do you know from the stick light properties, one has wacking, tumbling, rotation, wacking.
Yes.
And one has to go to the chance to have K, I think, to get the full chaotic behavior. And the equation of the same type can be written down for the stress tensor. That's what we did some time ago.
Yes.
Just playing around, and then we found uses such a tensor, which has the characteristic, shear thickening characteristic, and there are equations in the literature
okay.
which I can conclude that there should be chaotic behavior. It has not been written up under the perspective
yeah, yeah.
today. But
okay, well, maybe that's something to check out. So that would be a fully differential model, but with enough stress components that you can get it.
That the chaotic behavior would show up at the level where one just takes three components of the second rank tensor.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't find the chaotic behavior
okay.
without anything
yeah.
else.
Okay.
But the five, it was strong.
Okay. The other thing I should mention is there was work by, and I've forgotten who was it?
May I add this, Malamache and Chikova was starting from Fokker-Planck type equation.
Yes.
Boiling it down to a tensors coupled. They found chaotic behavior for the flow orientation, but you could could use the same
yeah,
mathematics
exactly.
to interpret
so
it in terms
that
of
paper, I think, was that, I've forgotten the other authors.
Letter.
Yeah, exactly. The guy from Catholic University in Belgium. But anyway, yes, Malamache was the first author. Okay, so I should have mentioned that they had an imposed advected shear flow on a rigid rod system with a Fokker-Planck equation, and certainly they predicted chaotic dynamics for the director in the shear. So that is certainly related, for sure, and that's a differential equation, for sure. I agree completely. Oh, yes, exactly. So I was aware of that. I wasn't aware of the work you mentioned before that. So that's a little different, I suppose, because it's purely imposed. What you'd have to do is back out of that dynamics for the director to say, well, that gives you a stress, which is then chaotic at fixed gamma dot. I agree. Yeah.
There's a paper by Yarin in JFM a few years ago, just looking at the behavior of a triaxial ellipsoid.
What?
A Newtonian problem.
Yeah.
Triaxial ellipsoid in simple shear.
Yes.
And he finds chaotic orbits in certain parts of the planetary space. So again, it's a system with 3 degrees of
freedom.
The Euler angles to describe.
But that's Stokes flow, right?
Pure Stokes flow.
Yes. Now, Tom Mullen was telling me that he has experiments on three steel balls in a Newtonian fluid, which again is chaotic. So the Stokes flow certainly can be chaotic, that's for sure. But that's a bit different from kind of bulk viscoelastic behavior, doing this kind of coherent stuff over the whole system. But I would like to understand the relation, actually. I mean, because there's you know, especially with colloids, at the end it's Stokes flow. It's just very, very complicated Stokes flow. And all this shear thickening and stuff is some gross way of trying to parameterize that.
You chose to work on a shear thickening model for this.
Yes.
Could you do the same sort of thing for a shear thinning model?
Well, I was thinking about that also yesterday.
And that's actually
yes.
suggested by things like convective constraint rates, which might be, if it were delayed, would give you, if it weren't
yes.
there,
I couldn't see the easy way to just borrow our equations and say, oh, well, you have got sigma that way and gamma dot this way, and let's flip them over. That doesn't make sense because you get a silly sort of equation for the dynamics of gamma dot. I mean, you can't talk about gamma dot as being made up of local pieces which jump, you know. So it's not as simple as just swapping sigma for gamma dot in the equations we have, which was what I was sort of hoping at first, but that doesn't work. I haven't thought about it enough to see whether you can get sensible candidates there, but again, I think probably the advice is to go simple initially, and then maybe see what kind of more elaborate constitutive models that simple physics might reflect.
Is the size of your flowing unit uniform irrespective of the dynamic state? do you always have that single particle, or there are groups of particles joined together?
Well, firstly,
according to the microstructural model.
Well, in the mesoscopic model, they are. It's deliberately very vague. Those elements are. They are meant to be the same sort of element everywhere in space and time.
Was it like the jump model?
No, well, the mesoscopic model has identifiable structural units in it. After that, when I just wrote down the continuum models, there's it's all washed out. I mean, there's no, you can't answer that question. So in the mesoscopic model, the units are the same everywhere, but they sort of lock into each other in terms of their correlated time dependence. That's how it works there.
When you're talking about locking into each other, does it mean that they move in groups?
No. They're all communicating to each other through macroscopic parameters like the mean stress. And so if you impose a strain rate, what that says is that the mean jump rate has to be about constant. And so if some things jump, others jump less, so that the population of these elements are, if you like, in communication through a sort of mean field effect, which is via the macroscopic stress and strain rate. So it's a little subtle as to how they talk to each other, but it's a sort of mean field kind of description.
And what about the case of non-deformable flying units, where L is zero?
Well, no, because L is not a particle. That unit is not a particle. So even in a colloid with hard spheres, I can define a little piece of colloid and assign a strain to it, unless it's, you know, really at random close packing, when I can't. But if it's at any density that can flow without fracture, I can think of a mesoscopic piece with a finite strain. Whether it's a good model for that, I doubt. But that's what those elements are meant to be. They're not meant to be particles.
So what's your impression? Is there is enough evidence that there is chaotic behavior in these flows, irrespective, for instance, of the coupling, that there might be with the imperfections of the measurement apparatus?
Well, I think there's completely. Well, Didier was doubting this earlier, but I'm sure that there's chaos in some viscoelastic systems in essentially viscometric, or at least in couette flows, at negligible Reynolds number. So for me, that's what I'm talking about. Whether the stress is ever uniform in such a system, I have my doubts. And that it may be you have to have banding first, or you have to have something which has eddies or spatial complexity in it as well. I think we need a lot more experiments.
Yeah, I guess there are some specific questions about all these systems. And I'm just a little bit worried about all the discussion that we might have on what is the simplest way to get chaos experimentally. Mm. And coming back to some of the ideas that was expressed on the table, I guess probably we will discover that you can get chaos with a simple system. I mean, if you look at hydrodynamic instabilities, yeah, and you couple that with some degree of freedom, like doing that on nematics instead of pure liquid, you may find instabilities and special and all kind of exotic things that are very interesting. Nevertheless, I guess in the kind of community where we are, and because the complex fluid we are studying, they have something special compared to the system, and that's probably what would be interesting to study. And I guess the most interesting thing, at least for me, is how you couple hydrodynamic flows and hydrodynamic instabilities to something which is related to the flow, but change the structure of the liquid. And in this case, I very much like your model about this retardation effect, because I do believe that in the system we are studying, you have long time change of the structure. And it's because of this long-time change of the structure and the coupling with the hydrodynamic instabilities that you can get a very rich behavior. So I don't know how you can show that experimentally and how this can be expressed theoretically. But I do believe that one thing which is very special about our system is the fact that the flow does two things: classical hydrodynamics of the viscoelastic system and change of the system itself, change in the structure of the system itself. And that's the coupling of these two effects that makes something, I guess, special about this system. So this has to appear, I guess, as it is in a theoretical model to get some of the input.
I think I agree. Okay, so the case, the system which you looked at, which is lamellar, basically it's an onion, that thing gives you this limit cycle, is a disorder to order transition of the onions, right?
Yeah.
And then
in the case,
I agree. So in the other ones, well, the shear thickening micelles, it's some kind of gel structure, but everyone agrees there that you get a structure which is not really a perturbation of the of the Newtonian one.
Yes.
And for the shear thinning case, I'm sure you'll talk about this sometime, but there's also signs that the banded flow involves it's a phase, at least in some systems, a phase which is not the phase you started from. So then you have the kind of coupling.
All that is very important.
And it's, yes?
That's what I guess is very special about this system. My question is, okay, even so, I don't like so much microscopic model because they are restrictive in terms of everything that can happen. In these particular cases, it might be interesting to look through all the experimental cases that has been studied, and there are not so many, are just a few, you just cited three of them, but I'm not sure that there are so many of them, to try to understand what would be, what is involved in this long time behavior. And it can be either changing the concentration, you need some time by diffusion to adapt the local concentration in the two phases, and this gives you a long time.
In the sense of demixing,
but even if it's not a real demixing in terms of the thermodynamics, it can be a change of concentration under flow. And I don't know what it means exactly, but it might be a demixing, but not always. It can be a change of the structure or texture of a fluid which has some texture, which is the case of the laminar phase. But it can be also other things. And maybe going through the experimental cases and trying to figure out what are these changes which are different from the instabilities of the flow, but maybe the consequence of the instability of the flow, I guess we can at least have a few physical insight of these systems.
Yes.
And try to put some things in your retardation function. Mm-hmm. And even if whether or not this retardation function is written correctly.
It's interesting because, I mean, the case which stands out, which doesn't seem to fit with that, is this very last one with the polymers around C-star, where it's very difficult to think of a long-lived kind of structural degree of freedom that is... What you're saying is that there has to be a lifetime for structure which is actually bigger than the stress relaxation time, I think, and that's how
you separate... Okay, bigger on the same order of magnitude. I do believe myself that the very interesting physics comes when the lifetime, the characteristic time of this change of structure is directly related to the characteristic time of the instabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where effectively you can get a very complex and very rich behavior. But I'm not sure. The last paper you mentioned, the paper on this C-star system, okay, I don't know whether or not it belongs to this class of behavior. I was very interested when I saw this paper a couple of years ago, but effectively I'm not sure that there is something really like a change in concentration or like a change in structure related to the...
Isn't the very fact of the C-star and doesn't it immediately bring into your class, because there both the composition structural time and stress relaxation time are uniquely at that concentration related to the diffusion it takes an average molecule to diffuse away from the ocean, right?
Yeah, my question is, but in this particular case, do they have effectively a change in concentration within the cell? I'm not...
Yes, well, more measurement is needed, obviously.
I'm not sure. If they have, maybe,
They could well do, because you see, remember that they're using parallel plates, they got very different shear rates in different places.
So I don't know.
So that would might be enough to set up
it,
the demixing just from that, and then you get something which was the coupling of the demixing kinetics with the viscoelasticity. That's interesting.
But I don't think the geometry in that last case is crucial. When you look at other people who worked on Taylor Fluette and so on and so forth, you see a transition to an instability. And then if you go even faster, there are new instabilities on top of the original instability, and chaotic behavior results. So I don't think in those fluids you're requiring to have two populations which are interacting in a complicated way, as you've described before.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more purely hydrodynamic, sequence of instabilities interacting in a very complicated way and giving you something chaotic.
Yeah.
It's a different sort of behavior.
You're referring to the Schottfey-Larsen-Bohler viscoelasticity.
Well, yeah, I mean, we know a bit about those. Yes, okay. And those, some of those are actually explained, right, on using essentially Maxwell models and the like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The
so there are, exactly. So there are cases where at least the initial hydrodynamic instability of certain flows in a viscoelastic material at Weissenberg number of order one can be established without the kind of extra degrees of freedom that you're talking about.
Yeah.
I agree.
So for me, the issue is not to show that you can have chaotic behavior in complex fluid. That's not the issue. The issue is to understand what are the consequences of this coupling.
Yes.
And maybe chaos, but maybe something else.
Well, I agree the issue is not to show it. For me, the issue is to get to grips with what is the minimal description of that allows you to say something sensible without basically trying to solve everything.
Can you comment a bit more about this meter scale model where you have this jump rate? This is related to the formation of structures that Didier is talking about and the relaxation back to some equilibrium state. I mean, what's your picture of what this jumping process is?
Well, we just view it as microscopic yield caused by shearing. So the things that the lurking behind the model is, which I didn't go into, is some sort of effective temperature, which says that things will rearrange even if you don't subject them to a flow. And then you have to have a feedback between that rate of rearrangement and what the local stress is. So again, there it's not easy to identify some separate slow structural timescale. But then again, also in that case, we never actually saw chaos. We just saw these limit cycles.
Yeah.